The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So what I'd like to do this morning is to hear your questions. Because it's one thing for me to sit up here and just hold forth. And it's another thing to actually hear what's on your mind and respond to those things. And so that's what I had in mind. So I wonder if any of you have any questions about the practice. So here already. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, one of the first surprises I had when I started looking at Buddhism was a concept of six senses. We normally think of five, you know, our bodily senses. And so Buddhism teaches the mind as being a sixth sense. Then we have mind object or, you know, mind experiences, which are the objects of perception of sensory mind. But I was thinking about feelings. How do we experience feelings? Is that a mental process? It seems to me like maybe there's a seventh sensor or something at times, that feeling, which is not exactly in the mind. Uh-huh. Maybe it's in the mind. It seems to be everywhere.
Great. Good question. So for those of you who don't know, Buddhism classically, you know, from back in 2,500 years ago, posited six senses, the five common senses that we think about, eye, ear, nose, tongue, taste, and touch. And then the sixth one, which is that inner sense that allows us to see or know what's happening in the mental world. So if you're aware of yourself thinking, then it's the mind sense which sees that, mind door, it doesn't fit. I mean, people, it's pretty easy to kind of push against these categories and say, well, things don't quite fit. Everything doesn't fit so well. So, for example, there are nowadays in the modern world, we have more than five senses. We have like proprioception, is that what it's called? Well, that's new. Or the sense of balance, maybe that's new. Or Buddhism might put that in the category of touch. You know, it's kind of physical contact, maybe. Who knows? But and so the question is about emotions, right? Where does that fit? Emotions are primarily composite events, and so to become aware of an emotion, you have to have a variety of senses are operating to become aware of it. If you didn't have contact with your body, so that would be touch, I guess, the inner touch, inner sensations of the body, then you. You wouldn't. It'd be very hard to know that you were having an emotion, emotions manifest in a variety of different physical ways, in the face, in the chest, the stomach, the shoulders, the hands, variety of places, and then emotions also, some of them appear together with various thoughts and beliefs and values, and then some of them come along with motivations. So there's an impulse to want something or not want something, and all the various sophisticated ways in which that manifests. So those things are operating. Are there other things that are operating with emotions as well? Is there an emotional center? Is there some kind of like pure emotional kind of experience that's separate from those body, thoughts, motivations? I don't know. Maybe. But certainly the human being has this amazing capacity to generalize. Consciousness or awareness generalizes from experience. And so we have a sense, oh, there's an emotion here. Whereas if you really go into it, below the generalization, you see it's actually made up of all these different elements. So, for example, the example that was given to me in Burma over and over again was that of... I don't know why the teacher liked it so much, but he liked the idea of if you look from a distance, a line of ants walking along the ground, it looks like it's a continuous line, like a black thread or something. But if you get close, you see it's actually made of individual ants, you know, following each other. But from a distance, the mind will generalize and see something. And so one of the fascinating things about doing mindfulness practice is being able to kind of tease apart the generalizations and start seeing what's actually going on there. And that becomes very important in emotional life because if we try to deal with our emotions as generalization, they can seem overwhelming or difficult or something. But if you start looking more carefully, what's actually going on here? You end up with a fascinating world of beliefs, of values, of ideas we have about who we are, ideas of who other people are, ideas we have of what's needed in life. A fascinating world of the body. The body is amazing. The body is like this amazing antenna almost, amazing book that reveals so much information about the relationship between the body and the world, us, who we are. And as we tease this apart, a whole new relationship to emotions can arise that doesn't arise from the generalization. Now, that was a long answer.
That's good. Thank you very much.
But it's a good question. Was there a reason you were asking the question?
No, just pretty much on face value what it was. I like your answer to look beyond the general feeling of emotions and try to drill down a little bit, be more aware of what's behind them. That's a good answer. I think I need to think about what you said and apply it for a while.
Okay.
And I'll get back to you.
Thank you.
Would you talk about the meaning of the word that in Buddhist history that's usually translated as equanimity, like in the Brahma Viharas? And I'll tell you what's behind the question. Well, part of what's behind it is I was recently doing a kind of self-inventory and realized how many of my bad behaviors come from lack of equanimity with uncomfortable emotional or physical situations, sensations. In thinking about this, I realized that I had sort of been assuming that equanimity meant a state, you know, kind of noun-y, where, you know, when discomfort comes up, you don't suffer anymore, because I know that's kind of one of the goals of practice. And I was talking to a teacher, Shinzen Young, about this, and he said, well, you know, I'm not sure if that's what they meant in the Brahma Viharas or not. He said, you know, I'd have to go back and look at the Pali, yada, yada. But anyhow, he said, when I use the word equanimity, what he means is much more of a verb of allowing the sensation to be what it will be, you know, not trying to stop it at the subjective level. I mean, you may take objective action to get rid of pain
right,
or something, but given that the pain is there. Mm-hmm. So in a way, my conception was kind of a state and his was kind of a doing. And it just got me curious. I mean, is the doing the way to get to the state? Or what's your understanding of all that?
So I'm curious about Shinzen Young. How is his way of doing? It seems like it was a lack of doing.
Well, right. But it's still, that's right.
The doing, not
but
doing.
But a lack of doing still seems more verb-like than noun-like. But verb and noun is my laying on to the situation. He used the word allowingness, you know, allowing the sensation to flow as it wants to in subjective space without, you know, trying to repress it in your subjective space.
Great.
And he said that's what he means by equanimity.
So yes, all of the above.
Yeah. Just interested in your thoughts on the general topic.
Well, great. So equanimity is a great topic, and there's all kinds of different angles or perspectives or aspects or ways of equanimity manifests. So there isn't just one thing, and in fact, you find in the ancient discourses of Buddhism lists of like, you know, three kinds of equanimity, six kinds of equanimity, 10 kinds of equanimity. You know, so depending on what we're talking about. And there's also in to make it a little more complicated, there's two Pali words that translate into English as the word equanimity. So there's difference, pointing to the idea there's different states, different things. So first, I'd like to point out that generally equanimity means something like a balance of mind or a non-reactivity of mind, where whatever happened, we stay balanced or we stay non-reactive. We don't get excited by what's happening. That's general. That's kind of a general kind of idea of it. If you look at two people who are that way, who are non-reactive, say, balanced, even in a difficult, trying situation, you'd say, oh, look, those two people are equanimous. And then you ask them, what's going on inside of you when you're so equanimous? And one person says, oh, this was a really difficult situation to be in. It was very challenging, and I had a lot of reactions to it, but I devoted myself to being really mindful, very attentive, so I didn't pick up any of the reactive thoughts and beliefs. And I almost broke out into sweat because I really had to kind of stay really attentive and present and not to be carried away. And by doing that, you know, everything stayed kind of balanced. There's a lot of doing because of the power of the reactive mind in order to stay balanced. The other person says, what trying situation? Or maybe there's, the person said, I realized it was a trying situation, but, you know, I've seen this kind of situation before, or, you know, I didn't take it personally. It just didn't push any of my buttons. Maybe I'm a mature person, I worked through all these things, there's no buttons to be pushed anymore. And so in that situation, there was no activity it needed. It was just, you know, there was no tendency to react inside. So sometimes, in order to be equanimous, there has to be some application of mindfulness, of attention, of work to find that place. And sometimes there's so much freedom that things just come through. Now, one of the principles for finding equanimity is to practice the sense of allowing that Shinsen talks about, to the ability to allow an experience to be there, to be present, whatever it might be, and then not be for and against it. Some people talk about just allowing the experiences come right through, like a sound. Maybe a sound is difficult, and if you react to it, but if we just let it come right through us, in a sense, then it's not a problem. And the idea of sound is an interesting kind of analogy for this, example for this, because there's a sound that happens, and then that sound meets something inside of us. And it's kind of, in a sense, it kind of gets stopped by it. So here, you know, Sunday morning, as people come in during the sitting, and it's a little bit noisy sometimes, and then what does that noise hit inside of you? So one thing it might hit for some people is my precious meditation. I'm getting so concentrated. It's getting so beautiful here. This is my time, and it's hitting my protectiveness, you know, or my special thing. Or someone else, it's hitting all their judgments about people. You know, how could people be that way? Someone else hits, it's so good to have so many people come. You know, it's really nice. It's very comforting to have so many people come. And people coming late reminds me I'm not alone. It feels really nice and feels warm. And so it hits these nice thoughts and ideas. And you're so welcoming. Someone else, they hear the sound, it doesn't hit anything. It doesn't meet anything. It just it's a sound. And it does no beliefs, no ideas, no reactions. And so it just goes right through. So we kind of say that it goes right through. So in a lot of experiences in life, what is it? What do we meet it with inside, internally? If we don't have anything internally that we meet it with, then there tends to be a lot more equanimity in the sense of being non-reactive. We allow it to be there. And one of the things that one of the big things that the world experiences meets inside of us is called the flag of conceit. And I love this expression, the flag of conceit. We lift up a flag. You know, and rather than the white flag of surrender or something, this big flag, you know, here I am, and then the world experiences meets this way we hold ourselves up. And it's possible to go through life without holding up a flag. You know, if you hold up a flag for a long time, your arm gets tired. And so what does it meet? So that's one of the very interesting areas of study in Buddhism is not what's happening out there in the world, as if the world is the problem. Sometimes it is, but rather than the interesting study is to turn around and see what does the world experiences meet inside of me. What are the needs? What are the wants? What are the values? What's the sense of self that's involved there? As we look at that, that tends to bring a greater capacity not to react, and then in a certain kind of equanimity. There's a different kind of equanimity that can come from, that's called, maybe better translated into English as kind of a balanced or balas. And the word is not upekka, but it's tatra majjatata. And it's usually translated into as equanimity. And this comes from maybe from a sense of inner strength or stability. When we're very stable and strong, then things don't push us around so much. When there's a sense of well-being. If you have a strong sense of well-being, then you're probably less likely to go to the refrigerator to eat, you know, because you're lonely or afraid or something, or all the other kind of ways that kind of manifests. So as something like Buddhist practice develops, hopefully it comes with a stronger sense of inner stability and well-being and strength. And so things happen in the world, and we're not pushed around so easily. And so rather than equanimity coming from non-reactivity, you know, because of the wisdom of the mind, non-reactivity comes more because we have this really wonderful sense of well-being or stability, very much maybe in the body, here. And the analogy I like to give sometimes is that of, for sometimes when people, some people exercise a lot, after going to the gym, you might feel a lot of good energy and strength in the body, and you can walk down the street and kind of feel kind of this coursing blood or whatever's going on, and someone says something unkind to you on the sidewalk, and it doesn't really affect you. It's kind of just washes right off. Whereas sometimes when you feel kind of down already and don't feel very energized, feel kind of insecure, and someone says something unkind, and it's a big deal. But you have this, you know, so who you are, how you are, it can affect your equanimity as well. And then there's another kind of equanimity that primarily comes when the mind is very concentrated, very still. Mindfulness is very strong, and it's many of the generalizations have fallen away, all the conceptual way of experiencing things falls away, and we're really right very close to the detailed experience moment of things as they arise. And then in that very strong concentrated attention to the moment, there can be times when there is no experience of either pleasure or pain. And one form of equanimity is when there is no pleasure and pain at all, because of the nature of the state of the mind, that state of consciousness that a person's in. And that's a different kind of, that's a certain kind of equanimity. It's very, that's upekka also, used upekka. And that's also considered to be, it's a kind of equanimity that arises from very strong meditation practice. And then there's one more kind of equanimity that I can mention here. And that's the equanimity that's sometimes called grandparent's love. Grandmotherly love, usually it's called, but grandparent's love. Not leave the grandfathers out. And that's the kind of, you know, the grandparents love their grandchildren, but they've already raised kids. Generally, that's what it means to be a grandparent, generally. And they've seen it all that first-time parents haven't seen. And so first-time parents can get very excited by all the drama. But the grandparents, you know, they love the kids a lot, but they don't get reactive or caught up in the drama of child raising in the same way. So that kind of equanimity, the grandparents' equanimity, is taken to be a representative form of love. So equanimity is not just aloof, not aloof, but this is a kind of very loving, warm-hearted way of being related to people, but it has a lot of balance or non-reactivity or allowance in that love, like a grandmother. Does that help at all, your question? Sometimes I wonder, I go on and on and on with these answers. I wonder if I've lost the person long ago. Please.
I have a question, and I'll unfortunately haven't been able to formulate it very well, so I'll try to stumble through it. So my question is, in today's, let's say, scientific approach to various things, one of the keystones is the sort of general agreement that sort of objective results can be reproduced by anyone. In other words, they're given the power to do the same experiment themselves, come to the same conclusions to decide whether or not something works or not.
Yeah.
And in some sense, that also seems to be President Buddhism, in the sense that it tells you if you think about these things yourself, you will come to the same conclusions in some sort of general level. On the other hand, you've obviously read the original literature, and as a scientist, you would like to go back and read the original literature. But to what extent, given the fact that that was written 2,500 years ago in a language that sort of has been passed down, how do you go about sort of resolving the sort of necessity of understanding what the real intent back was whenever these things were written down by the Buddha or whatever? Or to what extent is that just irrelevant? It's simply, who cares where it came from? If you investigate these things yourself, as I'm saying it today in your language, you'll get to the same end point and whatever. So
great question. So if I can restate the question, does Buddhist practice, like mindfulness practice, lend itself to some kind of clear empirical path of understanding the nature of reality or life or something ultimate that's a very matter-of-fact and scientific, and does it allow us to get to the same place that Buddhism in its original form, teaching of the Buddha, was pointing to? And how do we know what the Buddha was pointing to originally? If the Buddha is supposed to be the authority for what we're supposed to be doing, can we have confidence that what we do today will in a kind of clear way get us the same place? Is that the kind of the question? Good enough? I'm a little bit shy, or quite shy, to call Buddhism scientific the way that many people seem to want to call it. There are people who talk about Buddhism as being kind of an early form of physics, and modern physics is just proving what Buddhism has known all along. I don't really think, it's like comparing apples and oranges. You can find things that relate and correlate and parallels, but to make too much of it, I think, is not so interesting or even useful, except that it builds up the status of Buddhism or the Buddhists who are connected to it. Look, we're scientific. However, it does seem that there's a very strong current in Buddhism, not everywhere, but strong current in Buddhism, and also in early Buddhism, to focus on empirical experience or the phenomenology of experience. And the phenomenology is a study that understands our experience of reality as opposed to understanding what reality actually is. And so that's why Buddhism can't be an early form of physics, because Buddhism is not so interested about the true nature of reality like a physicist would be. It's interested in our experience of reality to the point of how that helps us to do a certain thing. And we're not trying to study everything we can about the world and life. Buddhism is not trying to... The quest for knowledge for its own sake is not, exactly what Buddhism is about. Buddhism is much more narrow in its focus. And the narrow focus of Buddhism centers around the world of the suffering and the freedom from suffering. And that world of freedom and freedom from suffering... there's a lot of things that constellate around that as well. And there's some beautiful things like compassion belongs right to the heart of that. So what are the things that helps us deal with suffering and helps us become free of suffering? That's at the heart of it. Now, if you go back to the teachings of the Buddha, there seems to be a little bit different constellation of beliefs connected to this suffering and freedom from suffering than happened later in Buddhism or happens in modern America. Or even in modern America. There's this core thing, suffering and freedom from suffering. And the core way it's formulated is in the Four Noble Truths. So it's not a scientific statement. It's a statement of intent. If you're a person who suffers, so you have to be that kind of person, first of all, and you're interested in not suffering, then you want to study this world of suffering and freedom from suffering. And you have to study it empirically or phenomenologically in your own experience to understand how it is for you. What do you do? What is your activity of mind that generates and causes that suffering? And what can you do to alleviate that suffering? So again, comes back to you. You're the book. So in the Bible, the Christian Jewish Bible, it starts with God. God created the world. The Buddhist Bible, in a sense, doesn't have one exactly, but if there was to be a beginning of the Buddhist kind of canon, it would be the beginning of the Dhammapada, which says, Dhammapada starts with the mind. So Judeo-Christianity starts with God outside, in a sense. Buddhism has its beginning here with ourselves. So we understand here what's going on. And then we try to find some way to free ourselves from suffering. Now, this Four Noble Truth, then, can be packaged in many different ways. And one of the ways it was packaged in the time of the Buddha, it was packaged very integrated with, the belief in rebirth. So if you go back to the early texts, you almost have to conclude, maybe you have to conclude, that the Buddha's enterprise of liberation and freedom was closely connected with becoming free from the endless cycles of rebirth. As if endless cycles of rebirth, being reborn over and over again, is not as desirable as being stepping off the wheel of rebirth. As Buddhism went through its various permutations through history, the idea of rebirth and getting off the wheel of rebirth became sometimes less, sometimes more important for different Buddhists. As you come here to the modern West, you find you have, again, this Four Noble Truths at the heart. And then the question is, what are the other constellation of beliefs around that that might be important for us? For some modern Buddhists in the world, the idea of rebirth is still right there close to the heart of it. Because if you believe in multiple lives, there's something very closely connected to suffering in being reborn. And so they don't want to be reborn. There are other Buddhists in the modern world for whom this is not interesting at all. It doesn't seem very empirical. It's not phenomenological. It's not in my experience. It requires believing a belief system that's being handed down to me from a tradition, from other cultures or whatever. And I can't go that far. I can't do that. And from that analysis, sometimes I say, well, the Buddha belonged to his culture and time. And in his time, some people believed in rebirth. And of course, he would just kind of go along with that, because how would you think differently? Because that's the way you're brought up. But some of us were brought up differently, so we don't believe in that. So that particular constellation of beliefs that go together with the emphasis on suffering and freedom of suffering, we don't buy in. You know, we don't take along. So are we then following through on what the Buddha was really teaching? I don't know. But ultimately, I don't think there can be any authority for a human being. From a Buddhist point of view, there cannot be any authority for any human being except for oneself. And oneself has to look very carefully and honestly about what it is that is most important and valuable for this life of ours. What's our deepest intentionality? And then somehow through that, try to find a way. What Buddhism says is that if you can kind of tease apart the generalizations, the metaphysics, the kind of belief systems that you can't really prove, and kind of let all that kind of settle away, and be left with something really raw, really basic, that you come down to that the most basic and most essential thing that really makes sense, really kind of is to really address this issue of suffering at its heart directly, independent of metaphysics, belief systems, multiple lives, deities, all kinds of, you know, things. Really kind of look at it and deal with it very, very directly and immediately. And if you do that, then it's possible, and this is a claim that Buddhism makes, it's possible to, the ultimate claim in Buddhism is possible to become free of suffering, completely free. And that makes sense, that the whole life can be motivated and powerfully motivated and organized and found meaning in a life that's oriented around that. Not just for ourselves, but also for our community of people, for others as well, to help them. Is it possible? So that's the kind of Buddhist creed, kind of, to do that. It doesn't. Can you really do it? Can each of us follow the path to complete suffering that Buddhism posits? I certainly hope so. I believe it's possible, as a belief. Is it? But I can't know it beyond a belief because I don't have the, you know, a lot of evidence yet, a lot of people, but. It doesn't matter so much. What matters is that through practice, people can verify for themselves, and it can be repeated, like in the scientific method, that, oh, I can take steps to alleviate my suffering. Not all of it, but I can make a difference. If I cling, I suffer. If I let go of that clinging, I let go of that suffering. And I can do it in small ways. And sometimes I can do it in big ways. And it's really worthwhile doing it as much as I can. It doesn't matter if I can go all the way. It's just very meaningful to even go partway. Does that make sense? And so that's where the scientific method perhaps relates to Buddhism, is that we have to find out how we can repeat it for ourselves. So that was a long answer again. Did I lose you? was that relevant to your question?
Yes.
Whew.
Well, I'd like to go back to equanimity for a moment. So if a person would be in a deep state of meditation and feeling a pleasant feeling, How would you see that in relation to equanimity?
So you're saying if you're sitting in meditation, have a very pleasant feeling in meditation,
yes.
How would you see that in relationship to equanimity? Yes. Well, if there is no equanimity, there might be a feeling, there might be some people, I've known people, who have a lot of joy and rapture arise in meditation, and they get afraid. Or they feel, oh, I can't go there, that's not right. You know, I'm not supposed to, religion is supposed to be about suffering. And so they react negatively to it. Or someone else might say, great, finally, some joy. And they get all excited and they pop right out. That's a very common phenomenon. They get deep in meditation, get really excited, and then, you know, mind gets agitated again. So there's no equanimity there. Or there might be some real pleasure in meditation, and this is what I want. And it doesn't go away, but we hold on to it now. And, you know, you get tighter and tighter around it. Or we get up out of meditation and then we kind of always thinking, I have to have that again, I have to have that again. So there's no equanimity. Where there would be equanimity would be if the pleasure, the enjoyment arose and we stay very, very simple with it. Oh, there's joy. We're not for it. We're not against it. We allow it to be there. And perhaps there's a ways of working with it to help the meditation go deeper. But the mind is not, there's no sense of self related to it. Oh, look how good I am. I hope Gil gives me a medal. there's no sense of self related to it. It just is what it is in a very simple way. And it's there for a while. Fine. It goes away. Fine. Pleasure comes and goes. It's okay. Whatever. So that would be much more an equanimous approach.
Thank you.
So here, Jeff.
So I have a question about Buddhist psychology and dependent origination. It's kind of related to the first two questions. For any given unit of time, let's say a second, through our sixth sense doors, we're receiving just this enormous amount of data, you know, thousands of sense contacts.
That's all? you have a pretty simple life.
For each one of those, there's a consciousness that arises, and from that sea of those consciousness, we seem to pick out certain ones to pay attention to and then react to, usually. What happens to all of those consciousness that we don't pay attention to? How do we choose certain ones, and could a really concentrated mind be aware of all of the contacts and consciousness?
And why is this an important question?
Well, how does the mind work?
Oh, how does the mind work?
Yeah.
I don't know. What's more, it's an important or interesting question. maybe a little bit following up on what I was trying to say earlier. From a strict Buddhist point of view, we're only interested in understanding the mind to the degree to which it helps us become free of suffering. Not necessarily understanding everything about the mind. So maybe it's not necessary to understand all the great details of everything. But how does the mind work? And how does the mind, in the great diversity of experiences of the moment, choose one thing over something else to focus on? I think that's fascinating. It's a fascinating topic to look at the choices we make, what interests us. And it's possible the mind is quiet or mindful enough to see the very subtle choices that go on moment by moment. If the mind is fast and busy and we're busy in life, we don't see some of the subtle choices that we make. I mean, we can't see them all. There's so much to focus on. I mean, so for example, now I'm looking at you, and there's so many things I could notice about you. Why do I suddenly notice that you're wearing a blue jacket? And curious about your jacket and wondering where that jacket comes from, and maybe I need a jacket like that. You know, why would I start thinking about that when we're talking about this very profound, you know, thing about the mind and how the mind works? So that's, and there's just one of 10,000 things mind can go with. So what does it say about me? What's going on inside of me that my mind would gravitate away from philosophy to where that jacket came from? And so maybe it's because I'm cold. And so this is my being cold then makes me interested in jackets. Or maybe it's that jacket seems to, you know, give you a lot of status. And I would like some status. And so, you know, so then that says something about myself. So there's all this, you know, layers and layers of how we can understand our motivations, our interest in life, our values, our sense of self, our belief system, through looking at that question, why do we focus on anything at all? And that's very interesting, for example, in meditation. Rather than being upset that the mind gets distracted and wanders away, anytime the mind wanders away someplace, it's an indication that the mind is interested in something, no matter how petty it might be. And so rather than being disinterested in being distracted, you can get interested in being distracted because it represents some interest. Why am I interested in this? Why am I starting thinking about pizza? So I'm sitting here minding my own business, and now I'm planning my menu. Why is that interesting? And as we look at this issue of interest, why is the mind interested in that? Then we can also ask the question, what is really valuable to be interested in? And do we have some capacity to choose what to be interested in? And I think that Buddhism encourages us to start exercising the power of choice about where our interest goes. So take interest in our interest, and then evaluate where is it the most interesting for us to focus on. And then to kind of differentiate and start exercising choice to focus on those things which are most useful for us to focus on, ways of being. And different Buddhist traditions, all without saying it that explicitly, all Buddhist traditions will say there's something valuable to do with your attention. that's more interested in other things to do. Some of them will say it's choiceless awareness, which means, you know, don't choose, but just be very, very open. So others say it's really useful for you to focus on your suffering. Other people, or the suffering of others, if you want to be compassionate. Other people say it's interesting to go focus on how your mind works, your question. And so to look much more detail, what is going on in the mind? The choices it makes, this interest it has, the ways in which it moves towards things and away from things, and thinks about things and conceptualizes things, and you know, start looking at all this. So I don't know where I am now. Now, was that question relevant to your answer? Was that answer relevant to your question? It was? Helpful, maybe? Boy, that's nice. So maybe the last one, and then we should stop.
I received a birthday card lately that was a picture of a group of Buddhist monks standing around a package, and the head monk has opened the package, and he's looking into it, and he says, "Just what I always wanted, nothing." Maybe people have seen this. When you speak about equanimity and all the different ranges of that, that's what I want. We want nothing. We want nothing to strike us. So my question has to do with, you've talked about Mara. I see you, Mara, versus, oh my God, I hate to be distracted, or reaction. Could you speak more about, am I interpreting Mara right in terms of that which comes at us? Do you understand what I mean?
I think so. The first time I saw that card was my sister-in-law sent it to my father-in-law. And because he's not a Buddhist at all, but he doesn't want anything. So she sent it to him. She sent it to him in a big box. A really big box. And probably when he got this big box, he said, "Oh no, more stuff. I don't want stuff, you know." And so he opened it. There was nothing in the box except that card. So he put it on his kitchen wall. And what we want is nothing. He said, "You don't want nothing to strike us." I think a more profound desire or question would be, not be so interested in what strikes us, but focus on what's being struck. And rather than not having anything strike us, because we can't stop the world. The world is what it is. But you can be empty. And so it doesn't strike anything. So, you know, if someone says to me, you know, that men who wear black pants are silly, it doesn't hit anything, it doesn't go anything, you know, it doesn't affect me. There's nothing here to strike, to be met with that. So that's an interesting statement. But if you say something like, if you came up to me afterwards or now, said, "That was the absolute worst Dharma talk you've ever given in IMC. How could you have done it? And I wasted my time. I came from so far away to come here, and wasn't even a talk. It was a question and answer. It was so silly." Then it might meet something in here. It might strike me a little bit, you know. And so I have to more work to do. So I think that's where you should study. You should see. Don't be so concerned what strikes you. Be concerned about what is struck. Is that okay? Okay. So may you all be strikeless. Unstrikeable. Thank you.